how is it that we can be so excellent in some ways and so base in others? How is it that we can feel in ourselves this kind of impulse toward immortality as though that were a right?
From this side of paradise, welcome to Eden Revisited, the podcast that puts shovel to soil and cultivates those interior gardens for the reenchantment of culture. Join us as we get to the wonder by getting in the dirt and sowing the seeds of faith.
Hello and welcome. Thank you everyone for joining this episode of Eden Revisited. This is Austin, and I'm joined by a special guest today, Dr. Glenn Arbery. Dr. Arbery, how are you doing?
Doing fine, thank you. How are you, Austin?
Yeah, not so bad. My first question, just to kind of kick this off, is did you do the 21-day excursion with your students this year?
Oh, I always have to say no. I got out here when I was too old. I'm still thinking I'll do it before I leave my 70s, though. Yeah.
Now, for people who don't know, we're going to get into a bit of your background as we go through this episode. You're the president of this college out in Wyoming that's doing something very unique. How do you describe it to people? I've tried to describe it to people because in the circles I run in, it often comes up, you know, whether it's after mass or talking about schools or education, your school does come up quite a bit. But how do you describe it?
Well, I think the best way to understand what we do is to think of sort of three legs to this stool. The two of them are very much like what other Orthodox great book schools do, which is, you know, have a very strong curriculum that's rooted in the best of the Catholic tradition. The other, you know, other leg there is we have, our students are pious. They're very interested in going to mass. And, you know, and some of them like more traditional forms, some not so much. But the thing that I think really makes us distinctive is the outdoor program, which has been part of the college since it was first conceived. A lot of our founders studied with John Sr. at the University of Kansas. He had this program called the Integrated Humanities Program that was really interested in much of the same things that I think you and your listeners are, which is getting back to the real experience of the natural world. They used to take students out stargazing, for example, you know, and things like that, just because it was an experience that was so rare in the contemporary world.
Do you ever have students who email you and say, I love everything you're doing. I can't do the 21 days in the wilderness. This is going to be too hard for me. Or is everyone pretty much on board with that as well?
Well, unless they really have some kind of, physical problem or illness that prevents them from doing it, we don't buy that argument. We say, no, come on. There was a young woman from Louisiana some years back who was convinced that she was unable to do the 21-day trip. I think she even confessed later that she tried to hurt her ankle the first week so they would take her out. But, you know, by the second week, she was hooked on it. By the third week, she was already thinking about how she could take this to others. So she got through the 4 years in great shape. She actually did become an outdoor leader, you know, on later trips. So, and then when she went to teach in high school, she organized similar things as soon as she possibly could, because they were so effective for her. Just kind of opening up the world in a way that she had not anticipated. She was a very bright, very literate student when she came in. And I just don't think she was expecting what happened to happen to her.
Mm. Yeah, I think about even in the name of Wyoming Catholic College, it's an interesting name because it's Wyoming Catholic College. Now, when you think of these other, let's say Orthodox Catholic schools, whether it's Chrysostom or Ave Maria or whatever it might be, or ones named after saints, you don't traditionally get the name of like the state or the locality in the school, but there's something very, it brings to mind something very particular when you think of Wyoming, the outdoors, the Tetons, something like that. And then Catholic, okay, so we have the Catholic identity center of kind of what you're doing, and then college. Now here's the intellectual, the academic. So even in the name, there it kind of goes back to those three legs of the stool and somehow what you guys are trying to do.
Yeah, very much so. In fact, I was talking to some of the men who had been at the Integrated Humanities Program in Kansas, and they were actually helping scheme to start this college some years ago. And it was very important when they shifted to precisely what you're talking about and started thinking about this as Wyoming Catholic College, because of that identification with the American West, you know, with the mountains, with these, you know, sagebrush prairies that we have out here, and the experience of the place itself and the, you know, the local character of it is very important to the way this education works. You know, we couldn't do it, you know, bless its heart, if this were Kansas Catholic College.
Or people even, wouldn't know what to think. I mean, in some ways it right. doesn't have that same sort right. of resonance of, you know, through movies and kind of just popular American culture. You know what Wyoming is. You think of ranches, you think of the outdoors, you think of mountains. And so it's a perfect name.
And those things are very much part of the experience of the students here. So it's not, you know, it's not a sort of blank identifier. It's really saying something that you just articulated.
Yeah. And a lot of what we talk about on this show is sort of reminiscent of our own name, Eden, Eden Revisited. And I know you have a lot of thoughts on this because you also wrote a book particularly about this. But what we try to do, maybe to our fault, but I'd love to hear your thoughts, is we try to kind of reconceptualize modern day forms of being, modes of life, things you do, whether it's gardening, whether it's making beer, whether it's going to church, and try to reimagine that in an Edenic sense, pre-fall sense. But if I have the gist of your thesis in your book, that may not be the right way to think about it. While at the same time, I think someone maybe could say that Wyoming Catholic, it seems like you guys are trying to do, you're trying to recreate something that is maybe of times of the past. Is that a conversation that's being had there, or how does that work?
I don't know that anybody here necessarily talks about the experience that they have, say, on the 21-day trip as Edenic, maybe because it rains on them up there or they get snowed on in August or things like that. I'm being a little facetious, but I'm also just pointing out that there's a great deal of difficulty, you know, built into the experience. I love Milton's Paradise Lost, which I think probably gives us, you know, one of the great poetic images of Eden. And I know what you mean. In fact, that my novel Boundaries of Eden is sort of about the allure of that conception of nature, you know, and our oneness with nature, the disappearance of all those separations that I think we feel all the time. You know, Rilke says, we don't feel at home in our interpreted world. Well, that's certainly not the case in Eden. You know, it's a place where there's a sort of immediacy and oneness with our fellow man or fellow woman and with the world around us. I think in my novel, I take up what I guess are some experiments in the Edenic, and that's, you know, perhaps coming out of my own experiences or experiences of others I know back in the 60s and 70s, when, you know, it seemed like it was just kind of easy to get back there. All you had to do was sort of drop all the conventional ways you thought, and you could, plunge back into that easy bliss kind of. That turned out to be pretty dangerous. Not taking into account, our real fallenness and our tendency to be selfish in ways that we don't recognize at first, and all those matters that don't need to be enumerated. But if you don't earn Eden, if you think it's somehow yours by right, I think it can be a very dangerous thing.
Education isn't just finding this perfect way it was done in the past, right? It's not about going back to the 50s, or it's not about going back to medieval. And like, if we could just recreate the education, then it'd be perfect. We have to acknowledge the present realities of the landscape that we're in and just kind of the American culture that we're in some ways, while at the same time teaching students what virtue is and what vice is and those sort of things. I mean, how is that done on a, how is that done on a practical level?
The experience of actual situations that require some kind of moral choice, even if it's, not eating this or getting up when you're still sleepy or whatever it is. Practically speaking, our students learn a lot of that, or they become conscious of it, let's say, in themselves when their limits are tested a bit in the wilderness, when they have to hike so many miles a day and, make their own, set up their own tents and, make their own food and plot their own course and things like this. What they're learning is, for one thing, a knowledge of limits. Things have consequences. If you do this, you can do that, sure, go ahead, but it's going to have this consequence, and maybe you want to think about whether that was what you were after. That's, I think, the way that we naturally learn virtues. The virtues are sort of the cardinal virtues, are excellences rather than kind of moral precepts. There's a way to be with respect to, say, eating and drinking and sleeping, or with respect to, sexual relations, or with respect to fear. There's an excellent way to be in nature that you see when you see it in others. You see why it's good to imitate that. But that has to be experienced. You can't just tell somebody this and then they can do it. It's a matter of forming habits, of going through lots of things. And so, all right, they learn part of that out in the outdoors. They learn to articulate it when they get back in the classroom. And what they're reading from the ancients is never idyllic. I mean, they start, for example, in their humanities course, we start with Homer. And the first thing that happens in the Iliad is this, ferocious quarrel between Agamemnon and Achilles over honor, and who's dishonored whom. And, so all this stuff about the prestige in which you're held and all these things, right off the bat are kind of the topic of what they're discussing. And, the women in the Iliad are most of them are captives who have been stolen, from conquered cities in warfare, and are divvied up as prizes among the men. I mean, it's sort of the, it's a kind of nightmare world in some ways. They negotiate that and, think about what it's like to be in that world. And I think the similarities to ours are readily enough found, there's never a point where they think that the past was this you know, perfect place. And if only we could get back to it, we'd all be fine.
Yeah. Well, and that actually brings up another question is, you mentioned Homer as maybe a foundation for a lot of classical educations. How do you navigate what your students learn? So what I mean by that is famously, like you can go to the Republic and see how Socrates is scheming up this plan of like training philosopher kings in a particular way, right? There's certain things they can learn. There's certain things they shouldn't learn because it's gonna lead them to habits and virtues and vices if they learn certain things. How do you find, like, why not just teach the latest popular fiction to your students? Why teach them Homer?
Yeah. Well, this question is best answered by, you know, having people read Homer, and then they see why this is better than anything. It's just the best thing, you know. It's sort of hard for me when I teach Homer not to see the rest of Western literature on the downhill slope, you know. But that's me, you know. I know there are a few bright spots like the Divine Comedy, you know. I'm kidding. But no, Homer is Homer manages to get at so many of the deepest questions, I think, that students are going to face in the Iliad and the Odyssey, actually. You know, the question of why we have to die, what mortality means, how is it that we can be so excellent in some ways and so base in others? How is it that we can feel in ourselves this kind of impulse toward immortality as though that were a right that's been denied us? And you see that particularly with Achilles. You know, his mother is this goddess. Had she married one of the great immortals, the child of that union would have been the greatest of all the gods. And here he is, you know, great as he is, you know, superior as he is to all the other mortals, still having to face the necessity of dying. Mm. You know, and so, you know, to feel the sort of agony of that working through the poem, I think just it puts that sort of nagging thing in all of us into a perspective, and, you know, it gives you a figure, you know, who rages, you know, against his mortality. It gives you that figure as a kind of not an idea, but an experience that the students themselves go through. And then when you get to the Odyssey, you know, here's Odysseus, who's not like Achilles. You know, he doesn't feel that same entitlement, you could almost say, to immortality. He's even offered immortality by Calypso, who the only condition being that he would have to stay on this paradisal island, speaking of Eden, you know, with this beautiful goddess, and nobody would ever know who he was. You know, he'd be complete. Her name means, you know, eclipse, you know, covered up, hidden. Mm. So he would have to stay there in obscurity forever, which just isn't what he prefers. So, you know, choosing to go back home, to be mortal, to have the real human life, and to earn fame and do things and face difficulties, you know, that's really what the Odyssey is about. So you kind of see the two of those as real, they sort of give you a direction, you know, for what follows in world literature, at least in the Western tradition. And I don't know, I can't think of a better way to start than there, you know.
So would the corpus that's in a classical education have something to do with asking questions that are meaningful and exploring things that are true? It's teaching students, whether it's Homer or, you know, later Dante, or, you know, in between those two, Augustine, as people are reading through some of those great works, are they searching, are the students searching for the threads of truth? Would that be an accurate way to describe it, or is that too trite?
No, I think that's exactly what they're doing. If they have their own real questions, let's say, Augustine's a great example. The Confessions. Augustine spends, most of his, not just his youth, but his early manhood, kind of trying out ideas and, sinning his way along, of course. But he's looking for something. He's looking for something that satisfies him heart and soul. And he doesn't find it until finally, that moment of conversion. But yeah, I think our students, even if they're cradle Catholics, even if they go to Mass every week, and say the rosary, I think there's still that kind of purchase of truth that they need, and that this curriculum helps provide. It's like all the questions that you need to ask, you really need to ask, you can ask and think through with your professors and your fellow students and come to some sort of satisfaction, or at least some way of holding the question open until you know it can be answered.
Maybe to tie a few of these, let's see if I can tie a few of these threads that we've been talking about together. And in some ways, I think perhaps Augustine's story itself points us to this example of, like you said, here's someone who's searching for truth. And for a long time, in an intellectual way, he would have even read probably Homer and definitely the Platonist and the Neoplatonist. But it's not until that point of that metanoia, right? That conversion, that sort of changing of heart that he gets it. And he has a few of those, but an ultimate one in the garden, which again, for our show is maybe poignant, but it's, going back to this idea of the wilderness too, and students kind of experiencing this, not only are they reading the journey of Odysseus, but they're actually kind of going on their own odyssey. I would imagine that's maybe a point of metanoia in their own life of maybe it's not outdoors, but maybe it's with other students, or it's kind of searching for the big existential questions about what am I going to do after leaving this, this great institution, that they really have to search for something. And it really changes inside of them, not just maybe in an intellectual way or something like that. Is that an accurate way to describe it?
I think that's very accurate. It happens with different students at different times. I don't know that all of them, say, would have a conversion experience on the 21-day trip before they begin their classes as freshmen. But sometimes that does happen. Sometimes on other trips that they take, for example, this week, our students are out all over the Mountain West doing various things, some backpacking, some kayaking, rafting, climbing, doing rock climbing, all kinds of things. But I remember one student several years ago, who just said very sincerely that when he was out in the wilderness, there couldn't be any question that God exists, It was just this sort of conviction that he had that came from the experience of being there. I think, again, as I say, I think it's different for each student, how it happens or what exactly happens. But, if we could manufacture the... the thing, there wouldn't be any point, would there?
Right. Well, that's exactly right. It's it's somewhat unpredictable, but in some ways, and in all the right ways, it's a very dangerous thing. And I mean that in a positive sense of, students who are really searching and seeking truth, being convicted in the wilderness that there's no doubt that God exists, that changes the whole course of your life versus just having it in your mind. And then the next thing is, where do I go? what do I do? And I would imagine that's what an education is for, is to somehow help those students think through, okay, I've had this sort of conversion, change of heart, whatever it might be. And now I have to figure out how to deal with this. Like, I have to actually, like, there's consequences, and, you know, you would say good, but hard consequences of, I have to go out and get a job. And, but how do I do that? Knowing what I know, that God exists, for example, that's a tremendous weight. Yeah, it's a beautiful thing, but it's a tremendous weight. And I wonder how you judge, like, how do you judge a student going through your curriculum as, what does success look like in that regard? What does it look like to be a successful student at Wyoming Catholic?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, you know, we have our kind of conventional measures of that, how much they participate in things, you know, how well they do in their classes, whether they're good in music, you know, and take a leading role in the choir, you know, all those things, whether they lead a lot of outdoor trips. But our friend who used to be president of the University of Dallas, a man named Donald Cowan, who really made UD into a great university back in the 60s and 70s, he used to say that you don't really know how to judge an education until 30 years out. You know, I mean, when you see what this has meant in the life of, in the whole life, you know, of a student, you see how these truths unfold and what that conviction that you're talking about actually turns into, you know, in someone's family, say, you know, when they marry, when they have children, when they bring up those children, how they what kind of moral life they bring to their work, what kind of influence they have on people who meet them, what kind of communities they form. You know, those are the things that are a ways out, you know, from anything that we can assess and send into our accrediting agency, you know, as proof that our education is working. You need time. You need operation of grace in the world, you know, however else you put it. But yeah, we're full of hope when they leave. We know they'll do well. We just don't know what they're going to do yet.
So your primary metric for success isn't how many students go on to be Wall Street bankers or you know, big shot New York City lawyers. That's not.
We'd like one of those to endow the school.
That's right. Yeah, get a few of those.
That's and right. We can sacrifice one or two of them to that one.
Well, that's exactly the temptation, I'd imagine, in some ways. It must be hard. I mean, especially being in administration, in some ways, I would imagine your most important metrics are not quantifiable. It's you know, how do you, I don't know if you guys accept grants or donations, but I think I read actually one time that you don't, at least from the federal government. But it's probably even hard for parents to hear, like, this isn't our primary end isn't the factory education of, you know, your student is necessarily going to get this shiny job at the end of.
Right. That's right. It's a hard sell if you make it sound too impractical. I don't think it is impractical, frankly. I mean, with the experiences these students have, including, you know, real hands-on leadership experience where they have to lead the whole group, you know, even before they start college, you know, for a day. And whatever they decide is what happens that day, you know, and has its consequences. When employers meet our students, they are delighted. I mean, these are people who are quick learners. They are present to you. They're not habituated to their cell phones. That's one of our policies that is kind of famous. You know, students don't have cell phones when they're here.
I love it. Yeah. I mean,
not just, you know, when they get out of class, they don't have cell phones. So that's been very effective, you know, just in helping them be present to each other and to what they're doing. you know, they still have laptops and I can get on the internet when they have to, but that's not the focus. You know, technology is sort of not the point of being here. So there are all kinds of ways that we're hoping these students will take a leading role in turning the culture back in more, just frankly, more wholesome directions. You know, it sounds like what you're talking about with Eden. That's a wholesome way to understand the good of human things, you know. So it's a permanent image for us.
Is there a right type of student for Wyoming Catholic, or is it any, you can form any student? For those who are listening, how do you know? What does it look like? What does that selection process entail for maybe some of our listeners who might be curious?
I would say that the student who will really thrive here has to have something of a spirit of adventure, you know, to be willing to, you know, to go on this 21-day trip in the mountains, which is demanding, to learn how to ride a horse. You know, we have a semester where they learn how to ride a horse. And this animal is not the bicycle you might think it is, you know. It's got its own mind, and it's a big animal, and, you know, getting it to do something that you'd like it to do is not that easy. The challenge of the great books in this context of, you know, largely framed by the outdoor experience and the liturgical life of the church. I think if those things are really attractive, then a student will love it here.
Have you ever had any non-Catholic students come?
Yes, we've had a few. I mean, most of them are Catholic, but the ones who are not Catholic have done just fine here. Yeah.
And what, maybe to close, kind of wrap this up, what are you, a big part, it seems like, of your specific influence on the institution is your love and incorporation of poetry and, you know, prose just in general to, you know, bringing your own background. Are you working on any sneak peek works we could have some insights, any more books coming out or any other writing projects you're working on?
Well, I write a kind of email column every week, you know, it's sort of about the college and about what we're doing, you know, with some maybe commentary on what's going on largely or at large in the culture, things like that. So I do those every week and they sort of add up, you know, over the course of a year. Those are all on our website. I'm also working on my third novel. Not getting quite enough time to work on it, you know, being president, but, you know, early in the morning, I'll get in a, you know, 100 words or so. Good days, 500 words.
Very cool. Well, what do you have a release date? When are you shooting for that one?
A release date? Wow. That's
or is that too ambitious right now? Too ambitious.
Yeah, that's a ways off on this one.
Okay.
Couple of years, I would guess.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you. Yeah, thank you so much for your time and, you know, this sort of short exploration of Wyoming Catholic and what you guys are doing there. I personally have loved kind of following it through the years. I think it was maybe 3 or 4 years ago that I stumbled across it. And it was as my buddies and I, who host this podcast, Nick and Tyler, were envisioning what a Catholic high school could look like in a similar vein. I mean, essentially we weren't trying to reinvent the wheel. It was, a lot of it was formed off of ideas that your institution has kind of, I think in a lot of ways, set ground on and made, you know, made possible, a vision of possible. So for our listeners, I'm gonna put a link in the show description of if you wanna listen or look at what they have. There's also a podcast that Wyoming Catholic puts out called The After Dinner Scholar, which is a great listen. And if you just wanna find more information, it's Wyoming Catholic, is it .edu, I believe?
That's correct.
Uh-huh. Yep, wyomingcatholic.edu. And yeah, just thank you so much, Dr. Arbery, for this conversation. And we'll have to catch up at some future point to follow up maybe and see how your students are doing and all that.
Great. Well, it's been a great pleasure, Austin. I really appreciate it.